everybody, and welcome to another beautiful, beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another exciting, wonderful show planned for you today. And as always, I'd like to start by telling you some of the things that are going on in and around New York City and in the news. First off, in the news, I was very happy to see the latest report that there is finally a decline in the obesity rate among young, poor children. And that's really great news, because as many of you know, 1 in 8 children in this country is obese. And we're talking about elementary school children. And amongst the African-American population or Hispanic population, it's 1 in 7. And so these numbers, this latest report, is really the first turn in the right direction, that finally maybe some of the work that has been going on to raise awareness about healthy eating is starting to pay off. So that's really, you know, uplifting news. Also, I was very happy to see that in the Philippines, 400 farmers in a protest tore up some genetically modified trials that they were doing on some golden rice that was happening in the Philippines. And this golden rice is really, you know, it was a GMO trial to see if this golden rice is going to be the antidote that they were hoping, that it was supposed to be genetically modified to be extra protein and extra vitamins and minerals, and it was going to, of course, be expensive, but it was supposed to, you know, help feed the hungry people. But it was being, these trials were being done before any tests were being done. And, of course, there was no testing to see any of the long-term effects, both in health and in the environment. So this action from these farmers who said they don't want this golden rice was really a nice act of, I wouldn't say civil disobedience, because I guess it was, but it could be a form of civil disobedience. But it was, you know, taking their beliefs into action. And, you know, I really like when I see that happening. Of course, you know, what happened in Egypt just day before yesterday was horrible. 500 or more people killed in taking their feelings into the streets. But I won't even go there. Also, the FDA has approved a gluten-free label. That is really big news. All food now will have a gluten-free label on it. Whether or not it's being just marketed that way, it's going to be a requirement, and that will be law as of next year. So that's big news. Also, in Take Action, you know, we're asking people to sign petitions about GMOs, as always, and also about fracking. Also, Big Ag is trying to silence whistleblowers, and we need to be allowed to speak up, and we need these people going undercover into the agribusinesses to show us some of the horrible, disgusting, law-breaking things that are going on. And so I have petitions on my website for both of these things, so that you can sign up to make it not illegal for someone to be a whistleblower, and also to demand more testing for GMOs and for labeling for GMOs. So you'll find those petitions on my website, and I really, really encourage you guys to please sign on. That's iegreen.com. Sign on these petitions. We need to all become activists in our own little way. And there's so many issues besides some of the ones that I bring up, and so I just encourage everybody to let their voices be heard, because there's so many issues that we all need to speak up and out about, and we need everybody to do that. Also, as many of you know, I am a co-chair of my local Slow Food Huntington chapter, and this coming month, the month of September, is Slow Food USA's big membership drive, and we're really trying to encourage people to join in this movement of Slow Food. And Slow Food is an umbrella organization that encompasses so many of the issues that I and so many of you think is so important. And by being a member, we're just setting up a framework and setting, you know, building a community of people that can really make a difference. And we are making a difference. I mean, in the 10 years that I've been involved with Slow Food, it has become so much more well known. And many people are benefiting from the Slow Food movement, but our membership is not really reflecting that as it should be. And so we're really encouraging those of you that really embrace the Slow Food movement to sign up. And it's not a lot of money. It's $25 to become a member. And that gives you discounts to all the Slow Food chapter events, whether it's your local Slow Food Huntington chapter or you want to participate in something in New York City. You get that discount. You also will be allowed to nominate restaurants for our Slow Food Snail of Approval, which is our new program in Slow Food Huntington. We are trying to identify the businesses, both restaurants and purveyors, that are selling good, clean, and local food. And we will be taking nominations, and then we will ask the restaurant to fill out a questionnaire with many questions as to how much of their food they source locally, what things are raised in a humane, sustainable way, and ask them to be accountable to some of the Slow Food ideals. They don't have to be 100% in alignment, but I think 80% is what we're looking for. And those establishments that are can get the snail of approval. And so if you are a member, you will be allowed to nominate and vote on restaurants for that seal. And we're just looking to raise the membership. So if you go to the slowfoodusa.org website, you can register and become a member there. Our chapter is also tabling at local farmers markets. We're in Port Washington on Saturdays and Huntington on Sundays, and we're talking to people there and sharing some of the issues that are so close to our heart. So hope to see some of you out at the farmers market and as new members with Slow Food. Some of the upcoming events. Tonight, I'm very excited. Tonight I'm going to a farm to fork event on the rooftop at the Brooklyn Grange. That's in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It's the largest rooftop garden in New York, and they are having a farm-to-fork event. And I'm really excited to be there. I've been wanting to visit the farm for a long time, and this is my opportunity. So that event is happening tonight. I'm not sure if there's still tickets or not, but if you are interested, you can find a link on my website, or you can go to parkard-slowfoodevent.bpt.me, or the Slow Food New York City website also has a listing for this. This Saturday, August 17th, there's a gardener's market at the Gateway Community Gardens, and Gateway Community Gardens is our local community garden that Slow Food Huntington helped to get off the ground in Huntington Station, and they will have fresh local vegetables that are grown there, cooking demos. The author, Arthur Schwartz, will be there speaking. There will be live music with DNA. There will be children's programs, crafts, painting. Lots of fun for everybody. That will be this Saturday from 10 to 2. The rain date is Sunday from 1 to 5. And we hope to see you there. August 19th, there's a big event called All for the East End. And that takes place at the Martha Clara Vineyards. And it's a fundraiser for many local charities on the East End. And so that's a real community effort. And they're all pulling together. There'll be lots of vendors there, great food, great drink. And Martha Clara Vineyards is in Riverhead. And that's from 5 to 10 on August 19th. August 23rd, there's another farm-to-table event, A Bounty of Nutrition. And this is an educational event from 5:30 to 8 at Fox Hollow Farm in South Huntington. And this workshop will include a vegetable field tour of their organic garden, Food Talk by nutritionist Marina Stauffer, and an array of tastings and vegetable dishes to taste. And recipes will be given out as well. So if you can come to that, that would be wonderful. September 11th, Slow Food Huntington, along with the Cinema Arts Center, are co-sponsoring a documentary screening of Spinning Plates, which is a wonderful documentary. Hope you can make it to that. Of course, we have a speaker and a reception following that event as well. Also, coming up on October 4th, there is an evidence-based natural and integrative medicine symposium taking place at Stony Brook University. And this event should be amazing. There's so many speakers lined up. Iman, who's my guest today, she will be a speaker there, as well as Ellen Kamai, Dr. Ellen Kamai, who is a radio host on PRN, as well as an incredible natural nurse. She'll be speaking there. So lots of speakers are lined up for this full-day event from 10 to 4 on October 4th. And it's only $35, and normally these kind of events are hundreds of dollars, so this is a really great opportunity to hear some amazing speakers. All about natural and integrative medicine. So if you can make that, I encourage you to do so. On October 23rd, the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food will be having their fall gala, so watch out for that. That's always a great event, and that happens at the New York Academy of Medicine, and that's October 23rd. And on October 27th, the National Nurse is also having the China Herb Walk, and that's, you know, a wonderful thing. Oh, and I forgot one other thing. October 2nd, Just Food is having their annual tasting benefit. This is a wonderful, wonderful event. I've gone to it for many years. I will be away this year during the event, so I will not be there this year, but October 2nd, Just Food is having their annual tasting. It's at the Altman Building, October 2nd from 7 to 10, and you can go onto the Just Food website to purchase tickets to that. I also have a link, of course, from my website, too. So those are some of the wonderful things going on in and around New York City. I want to share a recipe with you before I invite Iman on to tell us some of what she does. But Iman is the community garden coordinator in the Department of Medicine, or Family Medicine, at Stony Brook University. So she'll be joining us in just a few minutes. But first I want to share this recipe with you. You know, this is the time of year where all of our zucchinis and summer squashes are bursting in the garden. So, of course, I wanted to create a recipe using some of my summer squash. And it's also peach season. And finally, you know, this time of year you can get some really good peaches, locally grown. If you can find them organic, that much better. But this is the recipe. It's called Stuffed Summer Squash with Shiitake Mushrooms, Ginger, and Peaches. So preheat your oven to 375. You're going to start with 6 summer squash, cut in half lengthwise and hollowed out. Then you need 2 shallots minced, 2 ribs of celery finely diced, 2 long Japanese eggplants, medium diced, 1 8-ounce package of shiitake mushrooms, sliced, 2 tablespoons ginger, grated, 2 tablespoons garlic, minced, 1 carrot chopped, 1 zucchini, medium diced, 1 red pepper diced, some olive oil, salt and pepper, 3 tablespoons of tamari, and possibly more to taste, 1 tablespoon mirin, 2 cups of cabbage. We also have cabbage in the garden, so I put that in as well. 2 cups of shredded cabbage. 3 peaches that I did not peel, but I just diced up. 2 cups of cooked brown rice and fresh chopped parsley. So with a spoon, you're going to remove the seeds of the summer squash so that you're hollowing out the center. And then lay them out in a casserole pan with just enough water around the bottom so that they can steam while you're cooking them. And in a saucepan, you're going to wok the rest of the vegetables. You're going to start with the shallots and the carrots in a little bit of olive oil, and you're going to saute them for a few minutes until fragrant. Then you're going to add the celery, the ginger, and the garlic, and saute for another few minutes. Then add the shiitake mushrooms and continue cooking for another few minutes. Add the eggplant, the red pepper, the zucchini, and the peaches, and continue cooking until all of that is soft. Add the cabbage, the tamari, and the mirin, and let that cook down until the cabbage is soft, and that only takes a few minutes too. The cabbage cooks very quickly. Then add the brown rice and mix it all together. Taste it, and if you want a little saltier, you can either add more salt or more tamari, if you like that. Then you're going to stuff the zucchinis with the vegetable rice mixture, and then bake it, you know, fill the zucchinis with the rice mixture, and then bake it for about 30 minutes covered in the oven until the zucchinis are soft. And you can check the zucchinis just by poking it with a fork. And when the zucchini boats are soft, it's ready. And that's it. And then garnish it with some fresh parsley. If you have other fresh herbs, feel free to experiment with that. Rosemary is really good. Thyme is good. You can put any fresh herbs into this mixture that you like. But just know you're going with ginger and mushroom, so you want to make sure that it will go along with those flavors. But some rosemary would be nice in there, I'm sure. So enjoy it. I love feedback, as you all know. So you can send me some feedback at bhavani@ieatgreen.com or on my website right by the recipe. And these recipes are posted on the PRN website as well as on my website. So they'll be up by tomorrow, so you can check that out. Okay, so now I'd like to invite on my guest. Iman Margoob is a registered dietitian and landscape designer. And in addition to holding a master's degree in nutrition from NYU, she has a degree in landscape design from SUNY Farmingdale. Iman has always had an interest in combining the fields of nutrition and gardening, and is currently the community garden coordinator at Stony Brook Medicine, Stony Brook University in the Department of Family Medicine. And she's working on developing community gardens in low-income communities and managing the hospital's rooftop farm. Iman is passionate about the health of the environment and that of gardeners she works with, and so promotes organic gardening. Iman lives on Long Island with her husband and four children, and are often weeding the backyard vegetable patch alongside of her own. And so Iman and I worked together. We worked together both in the Small Farm Summit last year, and now we're together sitting on the Suffolk County Food Policy Council, which is really trying to make a difference. And one of the things Iman is heading up is a community garden website where anybody who wants to start a community garden locally can go and find all the tools that they need to streamline the process. And so this is going to be a public service website for getting community gardens started. And so I'm so happy to invite Iman on. Iman, are you with me?
I'm with you.
How you doing?
I'm great. I'm great. I'm listening to all your good information there and marking it for my own knowledge.
Great. Great. Well, you know, it's been such a pleasure getting to know you, working together on this committee for the community gardens. But I'm so intrigued with the rooftop farm that's going on at Stony Brook. So can you share with us a little bit about how long that farm has been running?
We started the farm in the summer of 2011, so this is our third season, and each year it has evolved. It started as a small 800-square-foot space. We got a very late start in the season, for as far as gardening is concerned, probably late July. And each year we've grown a little bit, and we've evolved, and this is, you know, now our third year running, and it's really developed.
And who runs the farm with you, or who works the farm? You have interns that work the farm, or students, or how does that
work? Yeah, I have a variety of people working with me. Primarily, it started with my colleagues, actually. We all just volunteered, and everyone on their spare time, you know, one dietitian would help stake the tomatoes, somebody would water, and as time went by and more professors heard about our program, they then involved their students at Stony Brook to put in some of their time, and, you know, maybe 6 hours was required per semester. And then the following semester, another professor heard about it, Mark Fasanella. He actually had his students put lab time, so part of their coursework was actually, their lab time actually was with the farm. So that's a spring course that he runs. And Professor Heidi Huttner, who also the sustainability, both these professors are sustainability studies department, and they have really been helpful in getting us going. And this year, the latest thing we've done is we've posted in the volunteer office at Stony Brook Hospital, it's one that now it's called Stony Brook Medicine. We've posted with the volunteer office positions at the farm, and we have an excellent response. We've had an excellent response from high school students and as well as Stony Brook University students. So that's kind of how we've been keeping things going. Last year we had some grants, and we were able to keep some interns over the summer, and you know, every year it's been a little bit different.
And has it grown? Is it bigger than 800 square feet now, or is it still?
Yes, it is. It's about, I would say, 2,200 square feet currently.
Wow.
Yeah. So we've almost tripled, sorry. And they're doing a lot of renovations on the roof at Stony Brook, so we're looking to expand at least double what we have now by next year. So we really have to get our working crew in order and really organize that better, because it's that's kind of the limiting factor. There's space, but we just need more people to be involved. And I think as people find out, they're very excited and want to be engaged. So that's kind of what we're trying to do now.
Now, to put this farm up on the roof, we don't have special structural things to the building to be able to adapt to that extra weight?
Well, the soil was already there. The building, I think, was erected in the 70s, and I'm not sure how long those raised beds existed, but they're, let's say, about a foot high, and they're geometric, and they had soil when we came onto the site, but it was completely covered with weeds.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't have to bring any additional soil. And anything we amend, for example, if we, let's say, amend with some compost and we bring bags up, we try to take things off. We try to compensate with the weight so we don't put a burden. And right now with all the renovation with the roof, we will be having a greener roof, so we'll be using a soil-less medium, sort of like Brooklyn Granges has up there on their roofs. I've visited their sites and spoken to them, and, you know, they're a wealth of knowledge, so it's always good to speak to people who have done it before and, you know, ask how it's done. So right now we're regular soil, but we will next year be moving to a soil-less medium.
What is a soil-less medium?
It doesn't have the heavy components. It's a silica. It's a lighter weight. It's made specifically for rooftops. It may have some coconut bark. It has just lighter, maybe some perlite, just, you know, different particles that help plants grow, but don't add the burden, the weight burden on a building.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear I'm going to the Brooklyn Green?
Yes, I did. I'm jealous.
Yeah, I'm excited. You know, you make a special vegetarian meal, but I didn't even realize when I bought the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out it's like a head-to-tail event, you know, so it's like using the whole lamb.
Oh, great.
So I keep writing them little emails reminding them that there's vegetarians coming. And they're like, yeah, well, but it's not a vegetarian event.
You'll have the cabbage head for you.
Right. So I hope they take us vegetarians a little serious.
I'm sure they will. There's so much bounty out there.
I know. So I'm very excited to go there.
Yeah.
So who benefits from the vegetables you're growing on your farm?
We focus all our efforts to patient meals. So anything that we grow is going directly on the patient trays. Right now, obviously, we don't have enough to grow to feed over 500 patients, but the way it works out is each day as we harvest, we bring it down to the kitchen, and the executive chef, John Mastatula, decides on what's going to be created as a special of the day from the items we present him, because it's, you know, from day to day it varies, so he really can't plan his menu ahead of time until he sees what we've harvested.
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning of the season, like in the late winter, we sat with the executive chef staff, and they requested, you know, which vegetables they would like to grow, have us grow, which herbs they could use to kind of work with their menu. And we also base it on what was most productive for us.
Uh-huh. So what are you growing right now?
We're growing potatoes, three varieties of potatoes. We have Cuca Gold, we have purple Peruvian. We have several varieties of tomatoes, cherry, and as well as yellow tomatoes, one called Taxi. Herbs such as lemon basil, regular basil, oregano. We've got zucchini. And for the first time, we're trying out sweet potatoes. So we have a nice size bed of sweet potatoes, and it's looking well right now, so hopefully it'll be a good harvest when the time comes.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, you know, I don't think of hospital food particularly as being healthy food. You know, hospital food has been traditionally food that's, you know, made by food service people from cans and frozen and really...
I think we've really made an effort. We've really tried to make an effort. And actually, I gave a tour at the university this past week to staff members to, you know, raise awareness about the farm. And one of the women there said she had just been recently hospitalized at Stony Brook. And she said, I have to tell you, the food was really good. And I think that's a combination of efforts between the executive chef, relatively newly hired executive chef that we have, and also my director, Josephine Conley-Skullman, who's worked from a nutrition point to really make sure that the tray that the patients are receiving is actually meeting standards and also, you know, is actually a tasty menu. And I think we have a fairly decent menu from what I've heard from patients. It's been a while since I've been there, so hopefully. But the feedback we're getting is pretty good. And the fact that patients are getting food that's grown right on the rooftop and that we're using organic methods is definitely a plus for a hospital tray.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what are some of the biggest challenges you've faced in setting up the farm?
I would say one of the biggest challenges is labor. You know, getting enough people to year-round. So we have students, and they're great, and they work with us through May, but then they have finals. And during finals, of course, you know, there's a lull. But we also have a dietetic internship program where we have 16 dietetic interns a year, so they also work very closely. So they cover that gap of, you know, till the end of June. Then, again, we wait for another surge of volunteers to come. So it's the unpredictability of who's going to be next, you know. So that's kind of the biggest challenge right now, because I think if we have people, it'd be easy to say yes, we can grow, you know, 5,000 square feet. You know, it's just a matter of being able to manage the space that we have, and that's kind of, I would say, the number one challenge.
Mm-hmm. Has the hospital looked at, you know, any numbers that do you think the farm saves them, you know, money as far as produce goes, or is it all just extra stuff that they give it?
Actually, I've been keeping track, you know, just for my own curiosity and to also inform. But the harvest that we planted last year, we raised, you know, it was equivalent to about $2,000, which is offset. So with time, when we have a more of a regular space and more of a regular harvest, we'll be able to present that and say, okay, this is what we have saved the hospital in dollar value. And especially since, you know, not all hospitals are serving, I would say very few, if any, are serving organically grown vegetables, which is, you know, a much higher cost, you know. So I think we're definitely keeping track of that, and hopefully in the future it'll have an impact.
And whose idea was it to start the farm, like, and where does the funding come from and the support from within? Because I would think, you know, even for them to pay your salary to be working on a farm as opposed to, you know, that's not normally what a dietitian is doing at a hospital. A dietitian is usually doing menu planning or, you know, some other paperwork. This is, you know, really thinking outside of the box. So it seems like you had to have some support from within. How did that all come about?
So I was initially hired to be part of a community gardens grant from the New York State Department of Health. My main goal was to start community gardens in underserved communities in Suffolk, and our goal was to start 10, which we accomplished. I worked with my director, Josephine Conley-Skullman, who had actually applied for the grant before I arrived on the scene.
Okay, wait a minute. So you were hired from Stony Brook to set up community gardens, not really as a dietitian for the hospital.
Not as a dietitian, but part of my role was to, by teaching, I'm not hired by the hospital at all, by teaching people how to grow vegetables, I was indirectly influencing the nutrition. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, with using cooking demonstrations is another tool. It's like teaching people how to eat without telling them, okay, this has X grams of fat, this has X grams of carbohydrates. It's bypassing all that and just showing them directly, okay, you're going to eat this zucchini and these are the nutrients. But without even speaking nutrients, you know that the peak amount of nutrients comes from a freshly harvested tomato or a pepper. So I know that, you know, by them increasing the amount of vegetables and fruits in the diet, they're going to directly improve their health. So it was an indirect way. That's a kind of a creative role for a dietitian. But there's more and more dietitians that are doing this actually through the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which is a formula of the American Dietetic Association. One of the groups that I belong to is called the Hunger and Environmental Nutrition. And if you go on their website, you'll see stories of more and more dietitians doing this type of work. It's becoming very popular.
So the Hunger and Nutrition Network?
Hunger and Environmental Nutrition. It's H-E-N is the acronym, HEN, which is kind of cute.
Uh-huh.
HEN is a subgroup within the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So they have a great website. They have great resources. It's mainly for registered dietitians, but there's also information there that would be possibly useful for the public. So when you go on that site, you'll see that there are more of us doing this type of work. And my work is not so much clinical, which is, you know, working with patients in hospitals. I'm more considered a public health dietitian, so I'm outside in the field, literally. That's more my work. As far as who had the idea, I think Josephine and I both were at a meeting together with administration once, and we were all exploring the idea of starting a quote-unquote garden in the hospital. And the two of us were extremely interested in starting it. And we were taken to see different sites, and you know, I saw the rooftop at Stony Brook. I knew this was the place where we had to start this farm. And I'd rather call it a farm, as I tell people, because a farm is mainly where food is produced as opposed to a garden where it's often ornamental.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we came up with the titles of a farm rather than a garden.
What is the title of the farm?
It's Stony Brook Heights Rooftop Farm. That's very fitting because we're up on the, you know, third floor of the medical building, the Health Science Center. So we are, it is a challenge. That's another challenge, I have to say, because everything that we have to bring up from the street has to be carried up flights of stairs or through a freight elevator. So we are not as high up as some of the other farms, but we are on a roof.
Mm-hmm. Right. I would think that would present its own challenges just being up there.
Definitely.
Well, I want to get more into the work you're doing actually out in the public with the community gardens, but first we're going to take a couple-minute break, so don't go anywhere.
Okay.
Everyone out there, we will be right back talking with Iman from Stony Brook Community Gardens. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Iman Margouf from the Community Gardens at Stony Brook University. And she's the coordinator of the Community Gardens Program through the Department of Family Medicine. Iman, are you with me?
I'm right here.
Great. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the work you're doing out in the community with community gardens. I know you said you set up 10 community gardens. Is that right?
That's correct. That was the original goal back in 2009 to start community gardens during the five-year grant process time. And the grant actually turns this coming March in 2014. So
will it be renewed, or are they going to be abandoning
the state? The state has decided to switch gears and have us do different types of work, more food policy work related to Suffolk County food policy. So right now, our main goal is to make sure these gardens are sustainable and have the means to stay viable and grow and expand and so on.
Mm-hmm. So where are the community gardens right now?
So we have 10. They range from, you mentioned Gateway Community Garden. That was one of our first gardens that we helped assisted with some grant money mm-hmm. as well in Huntington Station. We have Wyandanch, Central Islip, Brentwood, Bellport, Shinnecock on the reservation, Tuckahoe School, which is, I think, also works closely with the Slow Food, as far as I understand. And I'm probably missing one or two. Hobbs Farm has a community garden and Hobbs Farm in Center Reach. Let me see. Mm-hmm. Have I mentioned 10? I'm not sure if I mentioned 10.
That's okay, though.
That's a good number.
What has been some of the challenges in setting those up?
I would say keeping people interested and enthusiastic throughout the season. You know, everyone's very excited and has a lot of energy to work in the spring. But come the summer, the hot months, you tend to lose some people, vacations, the heat, and so on. And also people have very, very busy lives in those communities, whether they're, you know, taking care of one or two jobs, raising families. There's a lot of challenges, so it's keeping everyone enthusiastic and keeping everyone gardening.
Mm-hmm. And are the community gardens usually staffed with someone who assists if someone doesn't get back to their garden, or does it just go to weed?
So what we have is each garden is managed by a volunteer manager, and that person is my liaison to the gardeners. He or she helps me, you know, be the eyes and ears. You know, Iman, we need our hose is broken. We need a fence because people have children, but we don't want them running out into the street because they're young children. Some of the gardens are in busier neighborhoods. So those gardeners, those garden managers, again, they volunteer. They have a tremendous importance in our community garden program.
Are most of those volunteers people from within those communities, or they from your school?
No, they're absolutely from the community. We strongly encourage, if anybody starts a community garden, that they choose a manager that lives in the community, because that manager will understand the needs of the community and will be able to connect and bring people and draw people in, because they have similar interests and common interests. And when you have someone with common interests, you're going to have more of a rapport with that person.
Right, right. Yeah, that's always, you know, such a important aspect to remember when you going into communities. I know I've been in parts of projects where we've had to step back and take a look. You know, when you come in and you think you're doing good and you're trying to impose something on a community mm-hmm. as opposed to working from within that community and letting it evolve out of that community.
Right.
That it's, that they really own it.
Yes. It's theirs. And when I leave, it's still theirs. You know, I'm not running the garden. I'm not the person that keeps it alive, and I shouldn't be. I just provide the funds.
Right. So what have been some of the hardest parts about getting the community gardens going? I know from our work on the Food Policy Council, we've talked about water is one of the challenges.
Yeah, I just mentioned that. Every time we start a community garden, one of the things we do is site assessment. We first decide, obviously, for sun. Is there sun? Is there water? Does it have easy access for community members? Is it far away? You know, if it's going to be far, then people are not going to be less likely to go and garden. So facing water challenges in the first couple of years, a lot of our sites did not have water, and we needed to get hookups through the towns or so on. And it's been a challenge because the town obviously is concerned about pipes freezing, so gardeners tend to start gardening in April. And the first day of frost is towards late October here in Long Island, and generally municipalities tend to shut off water. But what happens in the following spring, they don't always turn it on in the beginning of the garden season. We've had gardens, for example, start their gardens really well. We get some spring rain. They go to the town, and they say, well, we need you to hook up our start our water, please. And the water has not been turned on until July. And you have people bringing
really?
I'm serious. I've seen it. People walking with their babies in their strollers and bringing milk jugs full of water from their homes to come and water their plants. That they've, you know, here you are encouraging them to garden and and it's hard work, as you know, gardening. And so you want to encourage them, but if there's no water, that's going to be a failed garden. Especially last year, we had, you know, high 90s for a prolonged time, and, you know, water is crucial and critical. And so what we're trying to do with the Food Policy Council is try to make it Suffolk County-wide, that established community gardens, if they're on public land, if they're on town or county land, that we would really like the towns and the county to make it more of a streamlined effort, so that there's a set date when water gets turned on community gardens. Right now, we seem to have been roaming on the totem pole, really trying to climb up that totem pole so that we get equal footing with parks and marinas and other areas that, you know, that public works services. We want community gardens to be recognized as equally important, because they're so critical in assisting with the health of Long Islanders.
Mm-hmm. I know from the Food Policy Council, there's also talk of how expensive it is sometimes to get that hookup.
Yes.
Have you had any success in getting the towns and the counties to fund that water hookup, or is it still going to be the responsibility?
Yeah, a couple of towns have been able to arrange a municipal agreement with Suffolk County Water Authority. So, for example, Brentwood, as well as Central
Huntington, Island. I think, right?
Huntington Station has, I'm not sure yet. I don't think they get an actual water bill at the community garden. The hookups, however, in several of the community gardens, even though the town doesn't give the garden a water bill per se, they have, on several occasions, for example, in Bellport, the Suffolk County Water Authority has charged a $1,600 application fee, which they have to get a grant for to pay for, because obviously they're working in communities that can't afford a startup fee of $1,600 between the family members. So, especially as a garden is emerging, it doesn't have such a large number of people starting the garden. Usually it's a handful, and then the word gets out, and then it grows year by year. So water is definitely a challenge, and that's something you and I are trying to aggressively work on to make it less of an issue, so that you know, we're on the front page as far as, you know, just raising awareness and to legislators and so on, that what is the role of community gardens and why are they important here?
Well, and they are so important. Have you seen any? Can you share with us some of the positive results or some of the wonderful things that you've witnessed coming out of these community gardens?
Yeah, I have to say, obviously Huntington Community Garden the Gateway Community Garden is a very successful garden. I think they've expanded and have added so many children's programs and summer programs, and they've been focused and driven. Another garden that I really want to mention is the Brentwood Community Garden. Started out by two women in the community who wanted to end violence in the neighborhood, Max McCastro and Anna Martinez, I want to say. And the two ladies have really just taken the bull by the horn. And the garden is not just for gardening now. They hold art shows and spelling bees and harvest festivals, and they're just dynamic and have made the area a real gathering place, and very organized and are doing really well. Other gardens, you know, Shinnecock has the family day. So each garden has had different successes, I would say. Over in Hobbs, they participate in Harvest Fest and Spring Fest. They've had, they were able to be very resourceful over the Elizabeth occasion. The manager there has been able to become very resourceful in getting grants for different aspects, you know, for drip irrigation, for just various things. So she's been very resourceful at getting grants to make her garden independent of, you know, the Department of Health grant. So I know that, you know, when you have financial stability, makes it more likely that you'll be successful in for the garden to continue.
Well, I think what I see happening with community gardens, and, you know, you also see this in the city in, you know, little urban gardens, little plots that are taking place, that these gardens are not only places that are growing vegetables, but it's growing a sense of community.
Absolutely.
And the quality of life that changes within the community is so measurable. I mean, it's just enormous. between community events and a sense of neighborly feelings and goodwill. It's just amazing. Like, I know I have, you know, been witness to the Huntington Station Community Garden Gateway.
Yes.
And, you know, there's, it's brought so many people together and given people a purpose, and provided a place to hang out and to socialize. And, you know, it took a wooded area where, you know, kids would hang out and, you know, do drugs. And there was a shooting there, I think, the year before we actually made it into a community garden. And now it's a place of community. It's a place where people gather. It's a place where old and young meet, where black and white meet, where Hispanic and black meet. You know, it's just there's no rivalry going on. It's just, it's like a place of love.
Yeah, and it is a beautiful setting as well. It's just, you bring a garden into a neighborhood, any neighborhood, and you bring beauty into it, you improve property value, you bring in goodwill, like you said. So gardens have, and obviously you affect people's health and physical fitness and diet as well.
Yeah. And I know you've done quite a few cooking demos in these community gardens.
Yeah.
Can you share what kind of things you showed people how to make?
I think one of my favorite has been the pickling demo. I think you and I were at one similar one. And it was showing people how to quickly pickle their vegetables, almost like a half sour, so they have to be refrigerated and eaten fairly quickly. And I love using the springtime vegetables as well. One of the challenges I had initially, we have our grant provides Scott Taskey at Crow Hill Farm with funding to help us grow seedlings in his greenhouses out in Amagansett. So the first year we had a lot of eggplant at a lot of the gardens, and many of the gardeners, you know, couldn't come up with a lot of ideas to do eggplant. So I think I remember going to gardens and doing, you know, eggplant three ways, you know, you know, healthy uh-huh. recipes. Keeping people culturally accepted vegetables, but showing them, you know, healthier options of cooking that same food, to make sure they're getting what they like, but also in a lower fat, for example, lower salt type of recipe.
Yeah, I've been amazed at how successful kale salads have been.
Yeah,
because they're a great one. You know, a lot of the times when we're doing these demos, you want to do things that you don't have to cook.
Okay.
You know, that are raw. And so the kale salad, people of all ages and all walks of life are loving. It's amazing.
And it's surprising because kale is traditionally a cooked down, you know, vegetable, because it's a chewy type of vegetable. So it, to show people different options and different ways of cooking the same thing that they grew up with is pretty interesting.
Yeah. I was doing a cooking demo a couple of weeks ago at the Wine Dance Farmers Market, and it was really interesting. A grandma came up with, she had her three grandchildren with her, and, you know, they clearly wanted to taste it. He goes, oh, you won't like that. And they were like, I want to taste. And they tasted it, and they loved it. She was like, you know, she tasted it, and she's like spitting out pieces of the kale. You know, I think she didn't like it, the kale part of it so much.
Yeah.
This is actually a cooked dish, not the kale salad, but the kids were loving it.
Oh,
and I think
good.
I was really surprised. You know, these kids were eating, you know, this, I think it was a vegetable fried rice, and they were really enjoying it. And, you know, she didn't expect them to want to like it, but it was all vegetables.
It's because it's green, and you don't think kids are going to like green, but if you make it tasty, they will like it.
Yeah, it was, you know, really great. They went away with three bowls of the vegetable fried rice. It was great. So what do you think the future holds for the community garden program, being that the funding will be being cut?
What we're hoping to do is create more of a unified community garden organization, you know, possibly, mm-hmm. I think we're doing that with the Food Policy Council specifically, maybe a Long Island Community Gardens, you know, organization, and having them connect with each other and pool their resources for grants, for knowledge, for events, and I think they'll have each other to fall back on. We ran a workshop this past spring, sustainability workshop, we called it, with all our garden managers, all kind of our garden managers, and they brought guests and we encourage them, you know, if any key people that played a role in the garden, we encourage them to come. We hosted it at the Wong Center at Stony Brook. And we provide them with resources, you know, which organic fertilizers to use for which situations, how to network and connect with your local banks or your local vendors, how to connect with other gardens. And also we heard some success stories. We had certain garden managers, for example, Matt Doris from Tuckahoe, give his presentation of his success story at his garden. And just by sharing knowledge with each other and having a connection with each other, they'll remain strong.
Right. Yeah, one of the challenges from Long Island is that it's so long.
Yeah.
It's so big.
Yeah.
You know, when you have all these little urban gardens in the city, you know, they're, you know, through an organization like Just Food or, you know, there's Slow Food, there's just, it's much easier because of the proximity of all the different gardens to feed off of each other and
right.
to communicate. But here, especially
yeah.
if you're in low-income communities where transportation could be a challenge, it's much more of a challenge.
It is.
And then build that sense of community amongst community gardens.
So true. It's so true.
Where I know there's, you know, more of that feeling in the city, you know, in Brooklyn and, you know, the community gardens, you know, they have events at different gardens, and they, you know, many of the members will go from one to the next, you know.
Yeah, I've been walking tours of community gardens in the East Village. I can hit, you know, 6-7 community gardens in just one walk, in just the East Village area alone.
Right.
Oh, so you're absolutely right about that.
Right. And it's so nice, isn't it? I mean,
it's amazing.
The abandoned lot is now like this vibrant, beautiful, green, food-producing lot.
Right. And that's what we hope to accomplish here, because there are all those abandoned lots in areas like, for example, in Bellport. When we went looking for the first site, there were several potential sites that could be greenified, if you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
or reused to convert into a community garden. So it's just a matter of raising awareness and bringing in a new idea into those communities, and that, you know, potentially, yes, maybe there's no farms in Bellport, but potentially each of those vacant lots could be growing, helping people grow food, and food that they can afford. You know, it's how much right now our grant provides all the funding, but, you know, membership of $10 a year or $20 a year can provide you the seeds and seedlings for, you know, several families to grow their own food and to really be able to say, yes, we too can eat healthy organic food without just going to a food bank or without, you know,
going to know what. Before we run out of time,
sure.
I'm just seeing the clock. I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to give people your resources so that if somebody sees a vacant lot in a town and they want to start a community garden, if they want to reach out to you, how would they do that?
My email is the best way. It's my first name, iman.margoob, I-M-A-N .marghoob at stonybrookmedicine.edu. I'm not sure if you can post that on your website, but I'd be happy to provide information. Also, the American Community Garden Association has an amazing website. The University of Missouri Extension, Cooperative Extension, has a great resource on community gardens as well. So,
we will soon have a website through the
yeah.
Food Policy Council.
Absolutely.
That will be hosted on the Sustainable Long Island website.
Yes.
Right? So that would
yes.
be a great resource.
We're working
resource.
With them. Yep.
Well, that's great. I will post your email, if that's okay with you. I will post your email.
That's fine. And I also, if you don't mind me making an announcement, we're going to be hosting a rooftop farm benefits Monday, September 23rd at 6 p.m. at the university, at Stony Brook Medicine.
Great. Send me that information. I'll send that out also on my newsletter.
Wonderful. I will.
Okay?
All right. Thank you so much, Vivani.
So everybody who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. I've been speaking with Iman Margoob from Stony Brook University, talking about community gardens. I thank you all for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you next week.